Well, here we are then. Television, society, screen-based culture. And television, in many ways, has kind of been with us since actually the end of the 19th century, after a fashion. People talked about projecting images on screen at the Paris World Fair and so on. But it wasn't really until the end of the 1920s that actually television started becoming talked about thing. People, if you look back at some of the historical documents of television, would see television very similar to what we would currently regard as Skype. In other words, it wasn't a broadcast medium, it was a way of communicating via one-to-one systems with other people in different countries, different worlds, and so on. Certainly that's one of the aspects that John Logie Baird had in store. It's one of the aspects Marconi had in store. So why then am I starting off this particular lecture with a photograph of some dead white men circus around a table about a radio show in 1942, the heart of, obviously, World War II and so on? Well, it kind of fits into the BBC, okay? Because John Reith, you may recall, the original Director General of the BBC, was somebody who very much polarised people. You were either for him or you were against him. It was his way or the highway. He saw broadcasting very much as his own personal crusade. And by all accounts, he really didn't have that much interest in anything other than radio, although there is an argument that said, well, if that was genuinely the case, the BBC wouldn't have been exploring the notion of television in the 1930s. Effectively, Ramsay MacDonald, the Prime Minister in 1930, was presented with a television set, which was the first sort of time where this device had been put forward into 10 Downing Street, long before, in a sense, regular transmission started. And test transmissions started in the 1930s, from 1935-1936, centred primarily on Alexander Palace. Germany had also been developing various other televisual systems, and there was a kind of general notion that this thing, this box with moving images and so on, had something to do with entertainment. Again, not too dissimilar to the way in which you might argue the World Wide Web, downstreaming and other such things fit in today. I noticed the news this morning, some people talking about 5G. In Lincoln, they can't even get 2G, let alone 5G, no, any kidding. But in terms of that whole line of things, we're looking to how you can actually progress and develop from there. Reith, as we say, was very much in charge of the BBC for pretty much its first 14, 15 years of existence until the mid-1930s when he finally left and became chief executive of British Airways. He was seen very much as an overwhelming individual, potentially could be abusive. He wouldn't stand for fools easily. He was pompous. He was humourless. He was arrogant. He was paranoid. He was self-pitying. And even his daughter said he was anti-Semitic. So again, not necessarily the most resounding character descriptions that you'd actually have for Reith as an individual. Autocratic, intimidating, they're also being used. And inevitably, far more women were secretaries than any positions of power. Most of the men had specific significant jobs and so on. The BBC originally set up as the British Broadcasting Company in 1922, became the British Broadcasting Corporation in 1927. And although it was still supposed to be a business, it's very clear that from most historians, including Asa Briggs' History of the BBC, which I'd heartily recommend, for Reith it was a crusade. Reith certainly believed that broadcasting should be seen as being above politics. And on the credit side of his ledger, I mean, I've given you some of the negatives there, his phrase to inform, to educate and entertain is something which again is still writ large in the BBC charter, and arguably it's something which serves as a fundamental basis for all good broadcasting organisations, that you want a balance between information, between education, between entertainment. In an ideal sense, you get all three. So why then did television, this upstart as Reith saw it, which was showing cartoons and various other things, why did it actually come to such an abrupt end. Because if you look at the programme schedules in the 1930s and look at back issues of the Radio Times, you'll find that certainly for the television schedules, there were similar generic forms as we have today. We had gardening programmes. We had antiques-based programmes. We had quiz shows. We had talent shows. We also had how to make your own bomb shelter shows, which perhaps we don't have today. At least I don't think we have. One of the suggestions was that broadcasting, television broadcasting, had to come to an end in Britain the moment war was declared with Germany, because the transmitters would actually act as a homing beacon for potential enemy aircraft to use to actually bomb places. So there's a sense that that was one of the reasons. Although you might say, well, it didn't shut down in Germany. And the other suggestion has been that actually most of the people who are working in television behind the scenes in terms of technical jobs within the BBC were needed to develop the work of radar and actually to help begin to enhance the work of the people who were specialising in radar. So they actually pretty much moved the boffins from Alexander Palace in terms of the civilian work to the wartime effort and so on. And the general apocryphal tale goes that the television broadcasting was suspended with immediate effect halfway through a Mickey Mouse cartoon in 1939, September 1939, and then in September 1946 it restarted again with an apology for the slight interlude as well. So as I say, television was there, but then why do we actually have this particular thing? Well, this is a good example of clearly the BBC did not cease to exist during the war, because it provided a very major route for politicians, particularly Winston Churchill, to actually provide his speeches and various other elements. And there was a consideration during the war years, first of all, how do we actually continue to serve our public? Do we go a hyper-serious route? Do we actually ensure that everything is sonorous, that we have music by classical composers, obviously not German composers, so no Beethoven, probably no Bach, but basically the kind of classic solid composers that we could rely upon with serious news? How did we develop this? Or did we actually say, well, okay, if we want to keep morale high, you need a kind of variety. You need a variety of other elements. One of the possible answers to this was to introduce this thing called the Brains Trust, which was a standard show which a group of eminent speakers would effectively gather around a table. Actually, you do have a female there. Sorry, I've completely... Yeah, do you see the whole range of things there? Token female, obviously. Still no white, single white female. And they produce something like this.
Aircraft woman, Ennis Jones, from The Wear. He says, lately I've come across a word new to me. The word is allergic. Someone says he's allergic to tomatoes, for instance. Exactly what does allergic mean?
Allergic is a compound word derived from two Greek words. One is the word ergon, meaning work, and the other was probably the Greek word allos, meaning other. And it means, therefore, working against or working in a different sense from, or in modern terminology, reacting against, because your work is other than the work of the thing against which you are reacting.
Campbell?
The Americans use the word rather as a slang word. They say you're allergic to tomatoes, for instance, meaning that they upset you. I know a person, for instance, who can't eat strawberries, comes out in bright red spots. I know another man, a bald-headed chap, when he eats marmalade, the top of his head begins to steam.
Doctor, quickly. Well, we speak of allergy in medicine in connection with diseases like asthma, where a person may be so sensitive to the presence of a cat in the room that, not knowing the cat's in the room, cat being under the sofa, they may suddenly develop an asthmatic attack. That happens not only in asthma, but in many other diseases. It means that the patient has an individual sensitiveness to certain things which other people don't possess. I don't know whether it's wise to go any deeper into it than that.
Doctor? isn't the point that it is sensitiveness to incredibly minute quantities, yes. Mostly of proteins?
Yes, that's true.
I know you would then feel again as if it's a fall heart if you're allergic. Well, I must say I'm rapidly becoming slightly allergic to Commander Campbell.
And so it continues. Although I must admit I've never actually experienced any balding individuals whose head has started steaming when they've been eating marmalade, but I suppose it could happen. In other words, what you've got there, received pronunciation, very much the upper class, chatting about things that might be of mild interest to them, but it's reinforcing that whole status quo, business as usual, that even though obviously we're at war with the Nazis, we're just at the end of the Blitz, we're looking for, obviously this would be slightly before 1942 Pearl Harbor, but business is continuing ever onwards. But this is a representative of the nation as a whole. And clearly one aspect about broadcasting is to develop that whole nature of who we see, when we see, and so on. News obviously is fairly vital, as is demonstrated by this report from the writer and poet J.B. Priestley about Dunkirk.
Dunkirk is another English epic. And to my mind, what was most characteristically English about it? So typical of us, so absurd and yet so grand and gallant that you hardly know whether to laugh or to cry when you read about them, was the part played in the difficult and dangerous embarkation, not by the warships, magnificent though they were, but by the little trader steamers. We've known them and laughed at them, these fussy little steamers, all our lives. We've called them the shilling thick. We've watched them load and unload their crowds of holiday passengers, the gents full of high spirits and bottled beer, the ladies eating pork pies, the children sticking with peppermint rock. Sometimes they only went as far as the next seaside resort, but the boldest of them might manage a channel crossing to let everybody have a glimpse of Boulogne. They were usually paddle steamers, making a great deal more fuss with all their churning than they made speed. And they weren't proud, for they let you see their works going round. They liked to call themselves queens and belles. And even if they were new, there was always something old-fashioned, a Dickens Dutch, a mid-Victorian air about them. They seemed to belong to the same ridiculous holiday world as pierrots and piers, sandcastles, ham and egg tea, palmies, automatic machines and crowded, sweating promenades. But they were called out of that world, and let it be noted, they were called out in good time and good order. Yes, these Brighton belles and Brighton queens left that innocent, foolish world of theirs to sail into the inferno, to defy bombs, shells, magnetic mines, torpedoes, machine gun fire, to rescue our soldiers. Some of them, alas, will never return. Among those paddle steamers that will never return was one that I knew well, for it was the pride of our ferry service to the Isle of Wight, none other than the good ship Gracie Fields. I tell you, we were proud of the Gracie Fields, for she was the glittering queen of our local line, and instead of taking an hour over her voyage, used to do it, churning like mad in 45 minutes. And now, never again will we board her at Cowes, and go down into her dining saloon for a fine breakfast of bacon and eggs. She has paddled and churned away forever. But now, look, this little steamer, like all her brave and battered sisters, is immortal.
And obviously because the new doctor is the Gracie Fields of her time. The sort of things people will actually do to trail ahead to Christopher Nolan. And Dunkirk and so on. This is all radio, and you might well say radio is fantastic. It's the theatre of the mind. People could still get visuals and images because they could clearly see these at newsreels, they could see them in cinemas, but television as such, no longer, not in there, not as far as Britain's concerned. So why am I kind of considering spending time on radio? Well, apart from being the forerunner of television, it's also something which also, because of its popularity, because of its penetration through society, it really started generating what we would consider to be the first personalities. And one of those major personalities would be, as we'll hear in a few seconds, from Itmar, it's that man again, Tommy Hendley, also the character of Mrs. Mopp. And this is a completely different take from what we've just actually heard. This is the time where, in essence, the decision to actually have an entertainment service to boost morale is also being made. It's also demonstrating how the BBC is very much taking on its role as being anti-Beeb. Remember, it's the sole broadcaster in the country, and so anything it wants to put together, including public service dressed up as humour, is perfectly legit.
Can I do you now, sir? Everyone's saying I can't blame the few. And where it comes from, I need to tell you. But if you're a servant, you'll hear clear and true. A sweet little voice says, I brought this for you. And can I do you now, sir? Can I do you now? If you don't want to eat, we'll have a farewell. I've done for the best in the land it is prime. I've done everybody, but never done time. On the day of Trafalgar, what he tells the same. Let every man here do his duty this day. So I keep the tradition with my gentlemen. Can I do you now, sir? GPFM, what do you think I've brought for you? One of these gorgeous dumplings. She made it out of her own head. But of course she took the headings out first. Now can I do you now, sir? Can I do you now? If you don't want...
Okay, in case... If you want to listen to the whole thing, you can do so. Just click on the link on Blackboard and it'll take you to all 6 minutes 43 seconds of double entendres, double meanings, can I do you now? It's a Tarts line within London, you have to do business, all sorts of other areas that are being used to develop that particular cultural image and impact that we're seeing there. All of which under the auspices of this particular aspect, in other words, Auntie Beeb, and the establishment, as we say, and this is it's basically serving as the central base of operations, still does in many ways, for the system. John Reith, there he is, dead centre of the whole BBC board extravaganza. And the board of governors are seen very much as monitoring the nation's morals, providing the nation's morale, boosting folk through. So even in this constructed image, this is where the family, with gas masks at the ready, will get their news from, in other words, the radio. Very much to the fore there. Three major radio services. The home service, which would probably be the equivalent to a kind of Radio 2-ish, Radio 1 and so on. Likewise, the light programme, which would be the equivalent to Radio 3, classical music programme. And the third programme, which is mostly speech and talk-based material, which would be the equivalent to our Radio 4, Radio 5 live. In terms of ways forward. And we'll return back to radio, as I say, in later parts of this particular module. And again, clearly one for all the family and the Ovaltinis and so on. There is Alexander Palace, where most of the early televisual work was originally set up and established, because it was, you still see it as you're coming into London, you take the train to King's Cross, it's relatively unmissable, and clearly it's a basis for actually transmitting televisual signals. Television, of course, from the whole notion of telegraphy, distance, television, sight, and so on. But television is a substantive beast. It's not like we have today with the ease of iPhones, applications, mojos, and so on and so forth. It's one where effectively you need to have some substantial areas to deal with lighting, to deal with sound, to deal with a whole variety of other areas. Back in the 1930s, there were two competing systems. One was Marconi, one was John Logie Baird. One of those effectively operated on the basis of 625 lines, the other one was 325 lines. And by that, I mean that basically television used to operate by the number of times an electron would be scanned across the screen, 625 times per second, an image would be built up. It's kind of analogous now, we've moved into a digital age, to HDTV and images relating to those side of things. Okay? don't worry, I'm not going to go into the physics of the whole system, so you don't have to worry too much about that side of things. Suffice it to say, there's a lot of stuff that actually goes into doing the news, whether you're perched on a desk, whether you're actually reading through auto cues, and so on. If you want to get a wonderful drama documentary feel of what television was like in the 1940s and 50s, then I suggest you check out The Hour. It was a BBC drama series of a few years ago, or The Hour. So, television is emerging. It's becoming popular. Why wouldn't it be popular? It certainly actually strikes huge levels of popularity in 1953 with this, the coronation. Because not only are we coming out of that wartime austerity, and we've spoken about this over the last couple of weeks, this is the opportunity where people actually have, for the first time, the opportunity to see a monarch of the country crowned in their own living room, almost. Admittedly, one or two of the upper class could possibly have seen this back in 1936, but that was very much the minority. This was a mass audience. And suddenly that whole notion of television joining radio, joining print, as a mass media form becomes very much the fore. In fact, arguably, soon on its way throughout the 60s and 70s and 80s to become the sole mass media form and bigger than any of its other sister media formats. But then, as in the best of cases, an interlude. And I'll talk a bit more about why interludes were actually there, why they were set in over seminars. But this was something which, again, was a throwback from radio. In many ways, if you look at some of the early BBC television programmes, the format was similar to radio, even to the extent of realising that you had to have separate times of the day for certain viewing habits, and that children should really be being headed off to bedtime or various other things about 6 o'clock. So after children's broadcasting may have been on from about 4 p.m, from getting back from school, to maybe about 5:30 or thereabouts, then you might actually take an interlude, or you might have a news break. You'd have certain natural breaks between the programmes. Not commercials, and it's critical to remember that this is not a commercial television service. Commercial television doesn't begin to enter the picture until the late 1950s, 56 and 57. When it's actually deemed that the BBC needed to have not only some competition, but also it was appropriate to consider having a commercial network as an alternative to the BBC, which was the advent of the independent television network, which then was set up on a regional basis. So you would have had in Lincoln, for instance, the equivalent of ATV, or East Midlands, East Anglia, Anglia Television, Tyne Tees further north, Yorkshire Television, and so on. So specific companies with the brief of actually looking after specific sectors of the country. Stars. Well, even if... Actually, they might have all died. They might have both died before anybody knew he was actually born, apart from myself. Anyway, both dead now, but you might have actually heard of them. Often hailed as big forerunners to Anton Deck. Well, technically just Ants now, or is it just Deck? Anyway. But in terms of that, Morecambe and Wise honed their skills and talents as entertainers on radio, developed, became really part of this group of ongoing superstars who would basically impact substantially in terms of people's viewing habits. If you have approximately 25 million people tuning into your programme, that's one heck of an audience. And when you've only got one channel, actually achieving numbers of 15 million to 20 million to 25 million, the kind of numbers you're probably only ever going to get now when England are in the semi-final of the World Cup and you're watching it collectively, and even then you might not quite sort of peak out at that particular area. So major sporting events, maybe arguably if you had a major incident, another coronation, possibly be up there, but you wouldn't necessarily get those kind of numbers. This was a regular thing. So actually, in terms of influencing folk, whether it was a case of quiz shows, you see on the right hand side there, Take Your Pick with Michael Miles, otherwise known as the Gong Show, Opportunity Knocks, which again I'll show you some clips on Thursday, which featured everything from comedy acts through dancing duos, through speciality routines, and so on and so forth. And the idea was that people would actually vote for their favourite act and the most successful act would come back next week. Sound familiar? Sound like a precursor to possibly New Faces, X Factor, The Voice, etc., etc. Not televisual votes, postal votes. Obviously, technology not being there quite solidly from that point of view, but you're still using that sense of the variety show, things that were proving popular. An awful lot of people who were working in television in the 1950s and 60s had come to television after working in the theatre, after working in variety, after working in other entertainment branches, because there wasn't any kind of notion of televisual history. Televisual literacy was being built up as we went along. The fact that the Marconi system had been decided in the 1930s as being the most successful one to go through meant that technology was improving, but most of this was still black and white programming, but it was popular programming. And if you were in the independent sector and in the commercial sector, what better way to actually fuel your popular programming than importing already popular programming from the United States of America? No language difficulties, as such. Lots of great action-adventure, because Hollywood had been providing stuff for the American TV industry pretty much since the 1930s, because it hadn't had a suspension of service, so it effectively had another 10 years of development. And so you get lots of other areas working through that. Also, in another one of those curious historical ironies, a number of people were basically being booted out of America because they were perceived as being communist or socialist leading individuals in Hollywood because of the McCarthy witch hunts. So you also get a number of writers coming over to Britain to actually work on shows and TV shows like Robin Hood and so on to effectively make other political points. So you get a kind of talent switch as well from that point of view. Genuinely all fitting into this notion of a golden age of television, probably led also by this gentleman here, father of David Dimbleby and Jonathan Dimbleby, the late Richard Dimbleby, who would comment on events ranging from major European issues through the funeral of Winston Churchill. He was also the gentleman who was most noted for having commented live on the burning down of Crystal Palace, where he literally commented on BBC Radio via a telephone box that he phoned in the report on, or basically phoned in live from that system. Again, in capturing that whole notion of the televisual commentator, that additional voice that in many ways starts writing the subtext to what it is the viewer is watching, rightly or wrongly. Some people like to watch the sporting events with no commentary whatsoever. Others find it absolutely essential that they actually have the commentator providing some input in terms of what's going on and so on. And the same thing for royal occasions, the same thing for state occasions. It's almost become a natural thing now that television without a commentary is a bit like cheese without biscuits. It's got a challenge. You can take it, but it's become something that's embedded in our culture. And speaking of culture, what about commentary? We've looked at things like Itmar, it's that man again, and other areas. Here we have two, some might say, giants of the early comedic scene, both of whom had major issues with range of depressions and various other things. Sid James from South Africa originally, and Tony Hancock originally from South London, but collectively working together to show very much an image of working class culture. A very amusing image of working class culture. One in which working class people can laugh at themselves and recognise their own kind of challenges in, you know, discussing everything from donating blood through fish and chip discussions through all sorts of other areas, but still embedding into that the normalisation. That's a key word when we start talking about how television impacts on social and political scenes, because what we're seeing here is a representation of a portion of the country. And there are certain key folk who aren't being represented here, which again becomes slightly more obvious as we progress. There is a series that was written by Nigel Neal that led to Hammer horror movies, starting off with Quatermass, and actually led to a whole range of other key things, including, I've actually got this little thing here, a motion picture which launched very similar, or in fact, it was just like this. Thank you. Yes, I know. We've got a situation there. A building site, post-World War. Have they discovered an unexploded bomb? Or is it the classical line of what we've actually got here, original evidence of Martians having landed on the planet back in the day? Is it actually the precursor to the woman who fell to Earth? Actually, yes, in many ways. No Quatermass, no Doctor Who. This was a phenomenally popular series in the 1950s, which, as I say, was a series of three serials, S-E-R-I-A-L-S, that proved to be so successful on BBC television that Hammer effectively bought the rights to it and then built pretty much the Hammer series of horror movies on Quatermass and the Pit, The X Experiment and Quatermass 2. Again, creativity was opening up in a whole range of ways, including, as I demonstrated, with respect to the science fiction representing our current environment and the events that we're seeing as well. And on from Quatermass and the numerous incarnations of that, to, in the mid-60s, the second BBC channel, looked after by Hugh Carton Green, who became the Director General of what was BBC Two, which also launched in colour. We're now in the 60s, an era that will continue sort of looking through and working through its impact and continuing resonance with the world today, which was very much based at this little place, which was obviously abandoned a few years ago now, the Concrete Donut, as we used to know it, but also BBC Television Centre, based in Wood Lane, something which again became something which was very much synonymous with everything from Quatermass through to Top of the Pops, current affairs programmes and so on. So clearly by this stage in the 1960s, 1970s, the BBC are established. If there's one word I'd like you to take away from this particular lecture, it would be establishment. Because the establishment, which is often represented by the mass media forms, is one of the key things that many people would either say that's fantastic, that's exactly what we want, or they want to rebel against it. In other words, they want to set up a counterpoint and think about counter-revolutionary aspects and various other things within that whole system. And the BBC has consistently always managed to just about tread an appropriate line between those three: education, entertainment and information strategies, including things such as Steptoe and Son. Again, another situation comedy series, and situation comedy is proving very popular. They tend to sort of come and go. I mean, my own personal favourite at present, and I would certainly heartily endorse you to check it out on Netflix if you haven't already. Binge watch, by all means, The Good Place. I think it's great. Any Good Place people here? No? Oh, never mind. Go to The Good Place. Very good. But likewise, half-hour situation comedies, in this particular case about Rag and Bone, father and son, hence the name, Steptoe and Son, in East London, dealing with a range of other challenges and situations within that, recognition, humour, and so on. This gentleman is a Canadian, was a Canadian, responsible for The Avengers. What, you mean the one with Captain America? No. The British Avengers series with John Steed and Emma Peel. Again, a series which often purported to raise a whole range of fantasy aspects and elements, and which we'll come on to when we start talking about the women's liberation movement, amongst other things. But, yes, it's time for your pop quiz question of the session. What other series was this gentleman responsible for green lighting? Alex, is that hand going up there, or is it just a case of, what? Now, are you asking me or telling me?
Asking.
Oh, you should have said it's Doctor Who and you would have been right. It was indeed Doctor Who, which had the first female major producer called Verity Lambert and launched with a four-part serial called An Unearthly Child in 1963, the same day that President Kennedy was assassinated. And viewing figures were fairly solid, very important, again, impressive enough for Newman to say that's fine. But Newman specifically said, and memos to this effect are easily located in the BBC and a number of historical texts, under no account did he want this time-travelling programme to devolve into a series which started seeing regular bug-eyed monsters from outer space being featured. Of course, the fact that the second serial was all written by Terry Nation, was about the Daleks, tended to kibosh that. By all accounts, Newman was so furious he was going to cancel the series there and then until he saw the overnight viewing figures, which has skyrocketed on the basis of the Daleks alone. So without this man, Jodie Whittaker, no job, okay? I'm sure she thinks highly of him, given that she's 35, so wasn't even born when this thing was actually on the template. In addition to that, the BBC is also committed in the 60s to developing a series of socially relevant dramas. Things like Up the Junction both the Up the Junction and Kathy Come Home focus on the subject of teenage pregnancy. Kathy Come Home in particular deals with the aftermath and how social services effectively take the child of a family headed by Kathy as the mother there, and there's some heart-rending scenes about how that's developed. And again, the question is being raised, does this represent what we see in Britain in the 1960s, when on the one hand we're being told by Macmillan we've never had it so good, and Harold Wilson, the white heat of technology, but on the other hand, there are people who are actually suffering a whole range of issues and challenges with respect to that, social and otherwise. And again, that documentary element comes across at this particular area. To many people, however, this can be seen as anathema. In particular, a lady called Mary Whitehouse, who co-founded the National Viewers and Listeners Association with the express aim, as you can see from the title of the book that Lord Longford is reading there, of cleaning up television. And that doesn't mean providing various cleaners to go around and clean the screens on everybody's household. No, it basically means they were deeply concerned at what they saw as an erosion of standards, an erosion of morals, and a whittling away of what was seen as British culture and a British way of life by effectively focusing on the unpleasant activities. Violence, sex, violence. In the 1970s, Mary went on record as, a whole range of letters which you can access, in which she was furious with Doctor Who because of the Tom Baker era in particular, where Philip Hinchcliffe had actually started using various horror tropes, and Whitehouse thought that was particularly improper for a Saturday tea time television show primarily aimed at young viewers and so on. Lots of cases where things were being raised across the whole thing. She almost became a figure of parody in the 70s and 80s. But, nevertheless, still raises that issue about somehow there are certain things that are right and appropriate and other things we should not talk about at all. This is an example of something we'll be going on to talk about next week. It's a series you're probably all familiar with. You're probably familiar with it from the point of view of, even if you never watched it, the media coverage that occurs, even with Ken Barlow, who's actually still around-ish. And Coronation Street was originally designed to be a six-week series, only 6 weeks. It was based on something, again, we'll be looking at, which is the work of the kitchen sink dramatists, or some of the angry young men, writers like John Osborne and so on, Kingsley Amis, who effectively wanted to really focus on working class culture. I think we should probably add the prefix white working class culture, reasons again which we'll make clear as we head through this, but you're still seeing areas that launch that whole process of on the one hand being a kitchen sink drama, but also open up into the world of soap operas. Second pop quiz question of the day. Will Alex go 2 for 2, or will somebody else burst in to say that's the reason why? Why do we refer to soap operas as soap operas? Come on, Mary, I know you desperately want to go for this. Yeah. Christian?
No. I always heard it was because the salt and soap in the advert.
Well, then you should have said that, exactly. It's not an apocryphal tale. The first sponsors of radio dramas which had cliffhanger endings and were based on series about ordinary people were Procter & Gamble. Procter & Gamble are one of the biggest manufacturers of soap products in the United States. Henceforth, from the radio world to the television world onwards, series which effectively dealt with purporting to be ordinary people and had cliffhanger endings and so on, and constantly were based on that, would be referred to as the soaps, soap opera, and so on. Another area that can be developed. As indeed is Zedcars, which, together with its companion, Dixon of Dock Green, very much started representing the notion of the police. And in the case of Zedcars, was looking very much to open up the notion of the police as perceived through the eyes of a Liverpool-based environment, which again was designed to be very much realistic. Yes, Everton Football Club and Sunderland Football Club. Actually, Sunderland stopped doing this, but they still run out to the tune of Zedcars even to this day. So it percolates even into football culture. Again, feel free to watch it by all means. You probably find it pales by comparison, but this was the Wire of its day. This was the Hill Street Blues of the 1960s. This was a range of other areas which was attempting to develop realism and drama. But we talked about realism, we've also talked about representation, and we've talked about various other elements. And allowing for the fact that one of the key questions I put to this is how are minorities and aspects represented, then I'm going to actually conclude the session today by screening a few moments of the Black and White Minstrel Show. Now, the Black and White Minstrel Show was very much the Strictly Come Dancing of its era. It was getting huge audiences, and it went from the 1950s pretty much until the mid-1970s. One of my tutors actually at the University of London actually was kind of responsible for raising the issue, what the hell are we doing with this? And when he wrote the Black and White Media Show, Bob Ferguson. But in terms of that, what we're about to see is something which on the one hand has its roots back in vaudeville and has its roots back in the wandering minstrel, in which it was deemed perfectly acceptable for white singers to effectively black up as non-white singers and pretend to be Old South Swanee River singers. Look at what we're going to actually see, and again, I just want to see how you relate to this from the point of view of the 21st century. Has it actually gone completely? If not, I'll have to find it all again. I don't actually put this thing through, sort of through that. Okay. Okay, let's have a look at it from 1978. Okay, here we go.
Wild and tame and cruel. Diva,
Okay, Lenny Henry, who is the only black person to ever appear on the Black and White Minstrel Show, said he found the whole thing so traumatic, he still kind of has to have has to sort of come to grips with the whole notion today. Overreaction, I don't know, but I can guarantee you there's not a hope in Hades that you'd actually get a similar show made anywhere across the threshold today. Now, you might well say, quite right, but what we'll be looking at on Thursday will be this and examples of other shows in terms of representation and how that is being presented in a sense as normality. Now, again, there are lots of issues with respect to this here, but you've got to bear in mind this also is at one end of a society which is also demonstrating, regrettably, both in America and in Britain, some some very unpleasant racial prejudice as well in terms of what things are coming through. So something to think about with respect to that. Has anybody got any questions about what I've been saying today? All clear? I haven't put up last week's lectures yet. Hopefully put that one up this week. It's been a hectic time. Thank you for your time, and I'll see you all on Thursday. Make sure you sign the register.